In the year leading up to the 2020 election, we're counting down the biggest scandals in American political history. This is number 15, the case of Alger Hiss.
Alger Hiss was used to being behind the scenes. His role as a policymaker in the State Department had never pandered to the general public. But in order to clear his name, he was prepared to defend himself before the cameras.
At a televised congressional hearing in August of 1948, under oath and the glare of camera lights, Alger Hiss confronted the man who accused him of being a communist, proclaiming unequivocally he had never been a part of the Communist Party. Hiss declared his accuser was a liar.
The accuser, Whitaker Chambers, did not back down. He insisted Hiss was the real liar.
Throughout the nine-hour face-off, neither man budged from their position. Hiss argued that he had been a dedicated government employee, while Chambers countered that Hiss had been a traitor.
Both men would go to their graves insisting on their version of events. The question remained, which version would America believe?
Welcome to Political Scandals, a Parcast original. I'm Richard.
And I'm Kate.
You can find all episodes of Political Scandals and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Political Scandals for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Political Scandals in the search bar.
Today, we'll follow the twists and turns in the case of Alger Hiss, a federal official accused of being a Soviet spy in the late 1940s. A respected diplomat who worked closely with the United Nations, evidence emerged that Hiss's connections to Russia were deeper than the State Department had ever realized.
We'll begin investigating Alger Hiss right after this.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement.
Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
September 2nd, 1939, one day after Nazi Germany invaded Poland, the Assistant Secretary of State, Adolf Burley Jr., had an unlikely visitor at his home, a former Soviet agent who was known to him only by the name Karl. A week earlier, the Soviet Union had signed a non-aggression pact with Germany. In light of that, Karl had some information that might be of concern. The U.S. government was full of Soviet spies.
18 of them, as far as Karl knew, including the special assistant to the State Department's advisor on Far Eastern Affairs, Alger Hiss.
To the State Department, this sounded absurd. These were some of their most respected colleagues. The charges couldn't possibly be true. Burley said he'd look into it. But honestly, the government had bigger things to worry about, namely the Nazis.
It would be years before anyone started taking Karl's accusations seriously. And in that time, Alger Hiss would become one of the most powerful diplomats in the United States. And the fallout of the scandal would change the course of history.
Karl was actually a Time magazine journalist named Whitaker Chambers. He was, in fact, an ex-communist and a former spy for the Soviet Union.
The Communist Party was relatively popular during the 1930s as the Great Depression devastated the economy. Plenty of well-meaning, left-leaning Americans joined the party, including Chambers, and, by his account, Alger Hiss.
Hiss was a well-off young lawyer in New York City. But while he was doing fine during the Depression, the devastation around him was too much for him to ignore. His wife, Priscilla, joined the Socialist Party of America. According to Alger, he didn't officially join her, but he shared her beliefs about helping the destitute and reforming corrupt businesses. That's why, in 1933, the 28-year-old Alger Hiss started working for the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, which offered relief for farm workers.
At this point, there are two diverging timelines regarding what happened to Hiss. He claims he was never involved with any communist groups or espionage. Chambers asserted otherwise. In fact, according to Chambers, in the mid-1930s, he and Hiss were part of a group that was aimed at infiltrating the American government, supposedly to help their good Soviet comrades in their struggle against capitalism. Chambers worked as a communist organizer and a courier for stolen government documents.
Hiss allegedly did his part by taking a job at the State Department. He served under Assistant Secretary of State Francis B. Sayre for 4 years before transitioning to the role of personal aide to the State Department's advisor on Far Eastern affairs. That role gave him plenty of access to top-secret documents on foreign policy.
According to Chambers, he and Hiss became confidants during this period, frequently attending Communist Party meetings together. Hiss was also brought into the espionage scheme. Chambers claimed he received his first classified government documents from Hiss in 1937. In turn, Chambers passed them up the ladder to Soviet intelligence.
By Chambers' account, the two of them became close friends. Chambers occasionally stayed over at the Hiss family's house, and Hiss, the magnanimous communist, even gifted him an old car. All was well and good for a while, until the Great Purge.
Over in the Soviet Union, Joseph Stalin was killing pretty much anyone who got on his bad side, and anyone who criticized him for it would have their name added to the execution list. Soon, Whitaker Chambers was sure his name was on that list.
Chambers was summoned to Moscow in July 1937. Wisely, he didn't go. After stalling for a while, he eventually defected from the Communist Party and went into hiding in 1938.
According to Chambers, Hiss cried when Chambers told him he was leaving the party, but Hiss refused to join him. Over the next few years, Hiss's career in the State Department kept barreling forward. When the United States joined World War II in 1941, the State Department became an active part of the diplomatic effort. And throughout the entire course of the war, Chambers' accusations against Hiss went completely uninvestigated.
Remember, the Soviet Union became part of the Allied powers 6 months prior to Pearl Harbor. The U.S. wasn't necessarily concerned about spies from a nation that was on their side. Not when Japanese forces were attacking islands in the Pacific and there were Nazis trudging across Europe.
Amidst the chaos of war, Hiss was finding great professional success. In May of 1944, he joined the Office of Special Political Affairs. Soon, he was promoted to the office's director, where he oversaw plans for post-war international organizations. The biggest task on their plate was the creation of the United Nations.
The UN would be dedicated to peaceful diplomacy among world governments, replacing its ineffectual predecessor, the League of Nations. 39-year-old Alger Hiss had a large role in the conference that drew up plans for the UN, serving as executive secretary.
The Soviet Union surprised the other nations' delegations at the conference by demanding that each of its 16 republics get a vote in the General Assembly. That would be somewhat similar to allowing each of the 50 U.S. states their own vote. It would give the Soviets disproportionate power. No other country was keen on this idea. The conflict would drag on, only reaching a resolution months later at the Yalta Conference.
In February of 1945, the Big Three, the United States, Great Britain, and the Soviet Union, gathered at Yalta to discuss the post-war restructuring of Europe and Germany. Alger Hiss, once again, found himself at the center of this historic moment.
As a member of the U.S. delegation, he was present to advise on East Asia. He also co-authored a memorandum countering the Soviet Union's demand for 16 votes in the UN General Assembly. The memo offered Stalin a compromise: 3 votes rather than 16. The Soviet leader reluctantly agreed.
Many critics on the right argued that far too much was conceded to the Soviet Union at Yalta. Hiss's memorandum, in particular, was contentious. Some believed it laid out a framework that benefited the Soviet Union over American interests.
Hiss's role at Yalta would cast suspicion on him for years to come, especially since shortly after the conference, a second Soviet agent came forward to accuse him of espionage.
Up next, the accusations against Alger Hiss unfold. Now back to the story.
After finishing his diplomatic work at Yalta in 1945, Alger Hiss moved on to serve as Secretary General at the UN Conference on International Organization. By all accounts, Hiss excelled in this new role. A Soviet delegate, in particular, praised Hiss as impartial and fair.
This was a little suspicious, given what the U.S. government was learning about Hiss. In November 1945, one of the top Soviet spies in New York turned herself in to the FBI, Elizabeth Bentley. The unassuming 37-year-old had started out as a courier, just like Whitaker Chambers, before eventually taking over an entire spy ring. She named almost 150 of her fellow agents, including one man in the State Department. Eugene Hiss, she thought his name was.
The FBI put two and two together pretty quickly. This was Alger Hiss, the same man Chambers had accused over 7 years earlier. And this time, they were going to take the claims seriously.
With World War II over, the fight against fascism had turned into one against communism. The U.S. and the Soviet Union were competing to be the world's leading superpower, and the former ally was now enemy number one.
In March 1945, 43-year-old Whitaker Chambers, now the foreign news editor at Time magazine, was once again questioned by the FBI. And again, Chambers accused Hiss of being a communist. This time, the FBI did follow up on his allegations. The Bureau bugged Alger Hiss's phone and began observing him carefully.
In March of 1946, Hiss was finally questioned by the FBI. He categorically denied any involvement with the Communist Party or the Soviet Union. With all the work Hiss had done for his country, he was stunned his loyalty was in question.
Or so he said. The investigation unsettled Hiss enough that he made a sudden life-changing decision. He would leave Washington and his prized federal career.
Later that year, Hiss took on a new job, president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. There, he hoped he would be able to promote peace through foreign policy without drawing too much attention from the FBI. As long as he was no longer a government employee, Hiss thought the FBI would abandon the investigation.
Unfortunately, this was just the beginning of a long, contentious journey. The FBI questioned Hiss again on June 2, 1947. This time, Hiss signed a statement categorically denying that he knew anyone by the name of Whitaker Chambers. He apparently didn't consider how easy that would be to disprove.
On August 3, 1948, Whitaker Chambers went public with his accusations. He testified to the House Un-American Activities Committee, or HUAC, that Hiss, among other government officials, had been members of a secret communist group. The charge sent ripples of shock through the public. had a communist infiltrated the highest levels of the United States government?
Or was Hiss the victim of a conservative witch hunt?
Either way, Chambers' damning accusation made front-page news. The New York Times headline the next day declared, "Red Underground in Federal Posts Alleged by Editor."
The sane thing to do in this situation would be to simply ignore the accusations, refuse to testify before HUAC, and hope the charges would fizzle out. That's what nearly everyone else Chambers accused did. But Hiss, for some reason, wanted to test his luck. As soon as he saw the paper, he sent a telegram to the chairman of the committee. He was resolute that he did not know Chambers and that the claims were baseless.
That wasn't enough, though. Hiss boldly requested to testify before the committee so he could clear his name under oath.
His request was granted. On August 5, 1948, 44-year-old Hiss testified before HUAC. On the floor, he stated, "I am not and never have been a member of the Communist Party. I am not and never have been a member of any Communist Front organization. To the best of my knowledge, none of my friends is a communist."
He went on to directly negate Chambers' statements, claiming again that he did not know Whitaker Chambers at all.
From the outset, Hiss had his supporters. Even President Harry Truman defended Hiss's innocence and denounced the inquiry as a red herring. It was a political hit job as far as the liberals were concerned. The conservative-led House committee was out to discredit Hiss and the FDR-era politics he'd become associated with. Because of Truman's admonishment and the lack of physical proof, HUAC was nearly ready to drop its investigation into Hiss.
That is, until a conservative first-term representative by the name of Richard Nixon intervened. Nixon pressured HUAC into appointing him chair of a subcommittee to investigate whether or not Chambers and Hiss indeed knew each other.
35-year-old Nixon had a lot riding on this inquiry. Not only did he dislike Hiss's liberal politics, he personally found Hiss bitter and condescending.
Nixon was pretty sure he couldn't directly prove that Hiss was a communist, but he could at the least prove Hiss knew Chambers, which was still grounds to charge him with perjury. With that goal, the subcommittee called Chambers back to the stand.
To prove that he did in fact know Hiss, Chambers shared as many details of their relationship as possible. For instance, he claimed that Hiss had lent him his apartment for over a week in 1935. He also divulged that Hiss gifted him his 1929 Ford the next year, though he originally misremembered the year of the transaction. Chambers recalled that Hiss was an avid birdwatcher and even recounted a birdwatching trip Hiss had taken where he'd seen a Prothonotary warbler near the Potomac River.
The next week, Hiss was called back to the committee where he continued to deny ever meeting Chambers. Halfway through the hearing, Nixon casually asked Hiss about his hobbies. He mentioned that he enjoyed tennis and amateur ornithology, bird watching. Nixon asked if he'd ever seen a Prothonotary warbler. Hiss replied, "I have, right here on the Potomac."
This was all the proof the committee needed. Chambers and Hiss did know each other very well.
Realizing he'd walked into a trap, Hiss introduced a new defense. He didn't know a man named Whitaker Chambers, but he did remember meeting a freelance journalist named George Crosley, who might have been this Whitaker Chambers fellow using a pseudonym. But he couldn't be sure without seeing Chambers in person.
His wish was granted. The next day, Nixon arranged for Chambers and Hiss to meet face to face. It was the first time that they were together in the same room in over a decade. Now, asked whether he recognized the man standing before him, Hiss's defense strategy started to descend into madness.
After examining Chambers for a moment, Hiss asked him to open his mouth so he could look at his teeth. George Crosley allegedly had very bad teeth, but Chambers's looked perfectly fine.
The baffled committee asked Chambers whether he'd had any dental work done in the past 10 years, and he said yes.
With that strange detail out of the way, Hiss declared that Chambers was indeed the man he had known as George Crosley in the 1930s. However, he was adamant that he had no idea that Crosley, aka Chambers, was a communist.
Chambers, needless to say, disagreed.
The day's hearing closed with no resolution, but that certainly wouldn't be the end of it. The disagreement was about to escalate into a national spectacle.
On August 25, 1948, Chambers and Hiss battled it out during a televised congressional hearing, the first in United States history. Due to the pervasive national interest in the case, cameras were allowed into the congressional meeting room for the hearing.
Under the added stress of camera flashbulbs and television lights, Hiss stayed undeniably cool. He repeated that during their encounters in the 1930s, he knew Chambers as a freelance journalist who was covering the State Department. He also admitted to subletting his apartment and giving him his old car. According to Hiss, though, the two men's relationship had ended soon after, and bitterly.
By his account, Chambers was a deadbeat who dodged paying his bills. Hiss underscored that the man accusing him of communist sympathies was a bumbling liar and he couldn't be trusted.
Chambers was irate. He countered with his own story. Not only was Hiss a communist, but they'd been best friends in the party. When Chambers quit, he allegedly tried to persuade Hiss to do the same, but Hiss refused.
Hiss felt he had one route left to defend himself. He asked the committee if he could question Chambers himself. Surely the Harvard-educated lawyer could bait Chambers into contradicting his own testimony. Once Hiss believed he had caught Chambers in a lie, he asked, "Would you tell me how you reconcile your negative answers with this affirmative answer?"
Chambers, tired from over 9 hours of testimony, replied simply, "Very easily, Alger. I was a communist, and you were a communist."
Toward the end of the hearing, Hiss began to lose his cool. He claimed that Chambers was using the congressional immunity of the hearing as a safeguard against a libel suit. Rising from his seat, Hiss walked towards Chambers, snapping, "I challenge you to make these same statements outside of this room, and I hope you will do it damned quickly."
Never one to back down from a fight, Chambers did just that. A week later, he went on the radio news show Meet the Press and said Alger Hiss was a communist and may be now.
Hiss responded by filing a slander lawsuit against Chambers almost immediately. He believed it was his word against Chambers, and as a respected diplomat, his word was far more valuable.
But in response to the slander suit, Chambers made a stunning revelation. Not only was Hiss a communist, for the first time he publicly accused him of being a spy. And Chambers evidently had proof to back it up.
Coming up, Chambers pulls out his receipts. Now back to the story.
Throughout the summer of 1948, the question of whether Alger Hiss was a communist was seen as a he-said-he-said problem. That fall, though, Chambers brought a new accusation to the table. Alger Hiss was a spy. And he had evidence to back up his explosive claim. 65 State Department documents, allegedly retyped by Priscilla Hiss, and 4 handwritten notes on State Department memos in Hiss's own handwriting.
Chambers provided these documents to the committee and purported that Hiss had given them to him in 1938. An initial analysis looked promising. The typeface of the papers matched that of the couple's home typewriter. The handwriting, too, was determined to match Alger's.
The statute of limitations was up for espionage charges, so both men were safe from prosecution on that front. But these documents, known as the Baltimore documents, opened both Chambers and Hiss up to an entirely new charge, perjury. Both of them had previously denied committing espionage under oath. If they were found guilty of lying, they could face jail time.
Despite the evidence against him, Hiss's story remained constant. He had never committed espionage and had never been a member of the Communist Party.
So, Chambers upped the ante. On December 2nd, he led Richard Nixon and his subcommittee to a pumpkin patch on his Maryland farm. There, he then opened up a hollowed-out pumpkin, revealing cans of undeveloped film that Hiss had purportedly given him.
Nixon made sure the press was there to document everything. The new representative was growing shrewd in using the power of the media as political weaponry. The pumpkin reveal was performative, no doubt, but the film did provide some hard evidence. While some of the pictures were of ordinary and publicly available documents, a small fraction were of classified State Department documents. This evidence became known as the Pumpkin Papers.
2 weeks later, a grand jury called Hiss to testify before them in consideration of perjury charges. His position didn't change. He denied any wrongdoing. What's more, Hiss claimed he had never given any documents to Chambers, and he didn't interact with him at all after January 1937, meaning the timeline was impossible for him to have turned over these documents.
But after deliberating, the grand jury reached a consensus. It indicted Alger Hiss on 2 counts of perjury, one for claiming he hadn't met with Chambers after January 1937, another for claiming he hadn't passed any documents to Chambers. While espionage charges weren't possible given the statute of limitations, these charges were about the same thing in the public eye.
Hiss was shocked. He clearly thought his pristine reputation was going to save him. But he was going to trial, and it was going to become known as a trial of the century.
Alger Hiss's perjury trial began at Manhattan's federal courthouse on May 31, 1949. The American public was fascinated by this strange, dramatic tale of communist espionage, and the newspapers covered every second of the trial.
The prosecution's main evidence was the Baltimore documents and a thorough laboratory analysis that showed they were, in fact, typed on Hiss's typewriter.
The defense had a hard time arguing against that evidence, but by God, they tried. They claimed Hiss was being framed. Chambers must have gotten the documents from someone else in the State Department. Hiss claimed that he'd gotten rid of that typewriter by the time the documents in question were typed, another apparent lie that was contradicted by a prosecution witness.
There was also the glaring question of why Chambers would go through all this effort to frame Hiss. To that end, Hiss's lawyers smeared Chambers in any way they could. They painted Chambers as an untrustworthy, mentally unstable deadbeat. He had dropped out of college, struggled to hold down a job his entire life, and he admitted to being a communist organizer. They even called a psychiatrist who speculated that Chambers was a psychopath.
On the other hand, the defense called a number of character witnesses who knew Alger well, including Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, who spoke to Hiss's upstanding morality.
Still, this character assassination wasn't enough to convince the whole jury. After hearing arguments, they were deadlocked. 8 jurists favored his conviction, 4 sought acquittal. According to friends, Hiss was shocked. He couldn't believe 8 of his fellow citizens believed he was guilty.
Hiss's shock was about to become dismay. After a retrial, which was more or less the same as the first, the new jury reached a unanimous consensus. Alger Hiss was guilty. He was charged with 2 counts of perjury. On January 25, 1950, he was sentenced to 10 years in prison.
Though he was nearly speechless at the verdict, upon leaving the courthouse, Hiss kept asserting his innocence. One day, he'd be able to prove that the documents had been forged.
Hiss believed he hadn't been given a fair trial. He was sure Nixon's disparaging public statements and the publicity of the HUAC hearings had given the jury unfair bias. He still claimed he'd been the victim of a conservative hit job. Unsurprisingly, many people, particularly liberals, agreed.
Nevertheless, after an unsuccessful appeal, Hiss headed to prison on March 22, 1951. Still insisting he was innocent, Hiss was a model prisoner, helping other inmates with their legal cases and working in the prison library.
Meanwhile, in light of Hiss's guilty verdict, Nixon and other Republicans used him as a symbol of the Democratic Party's corruption and deceitfulness and the threat of communism. Just 2 weeks after Hiss's guilty verdict on February 9, 1950, Senator Joseph McCarthy invoked the case in a speech in Wheeling, Virginia, effectively launching his own career of anti-communist hysteria. McCarthy claimed that the State Department was riddled with communists, a claim which, in fairness, wasn't entirely false.
McCarthyism, the fear of communists infiltrating the government, would run rampant through the early 1950s. And thanks to this divisive political climate, even after the guilty verdict, Americans were still split on the question of Hiss's innocence. As McCarthy's crusade spiraled out of control, the pendulum of public opinion would eventually swing back in Hiss's favor. Americans began to view individuals who had been taken down by his anti-communist agenda and the HUAC hearings that preceded him more sympathetically.
In 1957, an article in Nation magazine came to the conclusion that Chambers was not a reliable witness and that the anti-communist hysteria of the period had colored jurists' opinions. Many Americans agreed. In fact, by the early 1970s, Hiss had found his way back into respectable society. Frequently lecturing at colleges, he found himself a thoroughly enjoyable second career. But in the years ahead, additional information would surface that seemed to prove, once and for all, that the charges against Hiss were true. In 1995, the CIA revealed the existence of the Venona Project, a World War II program to decrypt messages sent by Soviet intelligence to U.S. operatives. Several of these decoded messages mentioned an agent codenamed Alice, who fit Alger Hiss's description almost exactly.
The most damning memo indicated that the spy known as Alice had been present at Yalta and had gone to Moscow afterwards for a briefing.
Alger Hiss had indeed done both of these things. Some experts today believe that the Soviets had even used leaked U.S. documents, possibly leaked by Hiss himself, to negotiate better deals at the Yalta conference.
As it happens, U.S. intelligence had access to these messages during Hiss's trial, but they couldn't use them as evidence without revealing the existence of the program, which would render it useless moving forward. If the public had known about the Venona Project documents, Hiss's defense would have been dead in the water.
And yet, after reviewing the Venona Project documents, Hiss released another statement denying everything. He claimed that he went to Moscow to see the city's world-renowned subway system, not to be debriefed by his spy masters. A shaky alibi at best.
Alger Hiss maintained his innocence until his death in November of 1996 at age 92. He passed away without the resounding vindication he believed would one day come.
It may never come. Many experts agree that the evidence points to Hiss committing espionage. It's also nearly certain, though, that the fervent claims of his innocence will endure for years to come.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with number 14 on our countdown, the Keating Five, when five U.S. senators were brought under investigation for corruption.
You can find all episodes of Political Scandals and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify. Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Political Scandals on Spotify, just open the app, tap Browse, and type Political Scandals in the search bar. We'll see you next time.
Political Scandals was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. It is executive produced by Max Cutler, sound design by Brendan Hawkins, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Travis Clark. This episode of Political Scandals was written by Matt Hartman, with writing assistance by Kate Gallagher, and stars Kate Leonard and Richard Rossner.